Tamam si çiğ mi şanı ni? Peki.
Pramiyasın kulağında duruyor.
Mari bir şey parayım. Mari beni
yazık. Tam kadar kam da tüm bir şeyin şeyde ya diye doğru cayna.
Yes.
Değil mi? Hoşuma sordu.
Mari da kadar kulağında duruyor. Çetun yine yönden işte zet çıkıyor orada. Da yönden de lo çambalı ya. Da bu çanayın tavşi etmemde.
Ben de Da şirə bu hasla bəyinə. Da bənə diyanda nə deyə səbəbini rəsm gəldə. Pasa. Şəmin. Necə gəldi? Sağ yüz qasa.
Alə də nə nə hoca.
Var. Gün çazandı.
Alə.
Tumbuşi dedi qasa. O tinidi var. Tinidi var tumbuşi. O tumbuşi de. Hani Dangan cikirin itu mesti deh, kata kemasan nampi, di lima ribu di na, dua ribu di na cikir, tadi sedang duji, so hati di tak boleh nampi. Tadi ngaji duji na kain cik, jadi, yang terus boleh nampi, cik dosa duji, yang hati di, nanti cak boleh nampi juga. Jadi tak kau kata, lusus, di tumbu susus,
As Honest was saying that it's quite difficult to kind of, you know, think off the cuff as to what kind of what you call the priming methods there might be in Buddhism. But you know, unless you really pinpoint in what particular area, because depending upon what specific qualities you are trying to cultivate, there would be different methods. And also, there is also a recognition of the need to be sensitive to the different emotional temperaments or the styles, one can use the term, of individuals. And he gave the example of a particular text, a Vajrayana text, which is divided into four parts. And each of these four parts have very specific meditations, including imagery practices, visualization of deities. And these deities, visualization, that when you visualize the deity, the qualities that you enhance in your visualization that the deities are supposed to represent differ. So some of these meditations are thought to be more effective and appropriate to individuals in whom the emotional kind of temperament, kind of attachment may be more dominant. And in some one of the four practices is really designed for individuals in whom the kind of the anger type may be more prominent, and in some, so there are different jealousy type may be more prominent. So there is an implicit recognition of different types of individuals for whom different types of practices, maybe meditation practices, may be more effective. And for example, when you do the if we take the example of cultivating compassion, then here there may be many different methods, one of which may involve visualization of a deity, the Buddha of compassion. And when you do the visualization, you imagine and you enhance the expressions that indicate the quality of compassion more pronounced. So there will be different types of meditation practices.
Tell a rajin, nyomong rik manguji ta ba namdo rik manguji ko rengshi de shu shu chung do da ji ta ba ji za de ji namme do dan de ji
so having said that there is
that the that thing when the detail shu che ni ne ga le nyomor ji la chu la go chu na de ne bei chase chase da ba na ba na shi dang ni mo le chaba gon se ya ji sun shu re re di ni 에 시당의 연보를 잡아꼽았대기 잡아꼽았대 찍어기 시당 나고 소도야 나와
그래
그래 저다 드림이 있잖아 또 드르디 소로 제제 그 그도 그도 그냥 못 돼야지 이때 에 드리심 사고 좀 좀 해서 소리 때 내가 짜오는 것도 없이 때문에 생기 남중에 배셔야 돼 마상 이문 시스템 야고 좀 있나 그 나서 신다 돈에 제도 그도 와
so although there is a recognition of the variability of individuals and the more appropriateness of different types of meditations. And also in correspondence to whatever particular afflictions, such as whether it is hatred or anger and so on, that you are trying to kind of, you know, deal with, there are specific types of practices. For example, the antidote for hatred is the cultivation of loving kindness and so on. However, the basic Buddhist approach is really to get at a more fundamental level. And there is an expression which says that there may be 100 streams coming from different directions, but they can all converge and run under a single bridge. Similarly, the Buddhist approach is to really get more at the fundamental level, and where there is a recognition that many of these afflictions, negative emotions and so on, they ultimately are kind of varying degrees of manifestations of more fundamental types of traits. So in the Buddhist language, we call them three poisons of the mind: attachment, aversion, hatred, or anger, and delusion. And these three... So of course, we have to be mindful of the way in which we're using the term attachment. There's a real danger of misunderstanding it.
This is, Dubin Jim said, anger and hatred. We can say craving and attachment. That gets it in the right context. Yeah.
And so even these three poisons of the mind are thought to be arising from a more fundamental state of a kind of a confusion or bewilderment, and
a fundamentally a false way of apprehending reality. I mean, it gets really deep of the we're getting it wrong.
So this is really, in other words, what Matthew was referring to as the grasping at this false conception of selfhood. And so given that recognition, the approach, and then this is, again, thought to be aided by a kind of a sense of cherishing for oneself, self-cherishing.
Self-centered.
So basically you have self-centeredness on the one hand and grasping at some kind of selfhood. So these two are thought to be really at the root of all the various kind of, you know, proliferation of, you know, destructive thoughts and emotions that come out of it.
These are primary. All of the other ones are derivative. So you have the primary, this reification of reality, oneself, but also other phenomena as well. That coupled with the self-centeredness. And then out of that flow these three mental afflictions. And out of that, derivative.
So therefore, the approach is really to target those two primary kind of forces. So that, and the idea is that the more you can release that gripping, grasp, whether it is self-cherishment or this belief in this kind of selfhood, the greater the freedom one will be able to experience. So that's the Buddhist approach. But to get to each and every specific affliction and trying to find an antidote is not going to be that effective from the Buddhist point of view.
It's only this part, just a bit more translation. This whole thing is just started by commenting that in theory, it is said in Buddhism, that there are 84,000 types of mental afflictions. But when you ask, well, exactly what are they? List them. We don't have any list. And although it's said that the Buddhist teachings provide antidotes for all the 84,000, if you look for those 84,000 antidotes, you don't find those either. So it's more of a general kind of a big number.
That's like 100 billion or 200
yeah.
billion.
Yeah, it's 84 or 90,000. So when you really get down to practical matters, you say, well, even if there are, if you can conceive of 84,000, they all boil down to three, and those boil down to. And so what we're really trying to do is cut to the root. Whereas you have other specific types of antidotes for specific mental afflictions, like for attachment, for anger, and so forth, if you're just taking them head on, you'll certainly be able to attenuate them. But just by those specific antidotes, like loving kindness for anger, you'll not be able to eradicate the anger or hatred so that it never arises again. You'll merely temporarily attenuate it.
Just small thing about the way that priming or preparing the mind is done. Obviously, in your case, either subliminal, then you know, but have nothing to do with it, or you ask them to generate a state. So in terms of cultivating this kind of positive qualities such as loving kindness or benevolence or care, concern, so the difference, which might be quite important, is obviously it's a voluntary, self-induced priming or preparation or changing your mind in order to develop those qualities. And it is combined with mindfulness in the sense that you remind yourself at all times that this is how I should approach a sentient being or approach, begin an action or begin a project or start the day. And you constantly, whenever the occasion occurs, when you're going to start an action or make a decision, even in a flash of a moment, just remind yourself, what is your motivation? And I must be clear in my mind that something that is done to harm others, of course, should be avoided by all means. But also something neutral. It might be much better to do something that's beneficial. So to begin with every single action, just even with a reminder of that motivation. So the mindfulness is there to, at all times, rekindle and revive that kind of attitude. So, of course, the beginning of the day is a crucial moment for that, to sort of give a different flavor to the whole day by saying, whatever I might undertake today may it be for the benefit of all sentient beings. And then try to remind that and check in the evening if you have done so. So we often speak of three ideas to frame any action, whether a practice or even an act of generosity or engaging in something. First, to again check your mind and turn it towards a more benevolent attitude before starting the action. Then be fully concentrated on what you do without grasping or imperturbed by afflictive emotions. And then in the end, to remind yourself that this was done with this idea of benefiting others, sort of sharing or distributing that. And so if we keep every action in that framework, then they will contribute to that. And then there's another thing, is that priming itself, we wish that it may continually increase. One of the main aspirations is, may my aspiration continue to grow. So we have a very profound and often used aspiration or prayer. May the altruistic mind that wishes to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of others. If it's not yet born, may it be born. If it's born, may it continue to grow without degenerating. So there is an actual priming to enhance the priming in a way, or the motivation. And so that's a self-nourishing sort of flourishing.
One of the things that, I think this is extremely different from what we do in our daily lives. It reminds me of your question about the research ethics course. That research ethics course in the United States psychology departments is a response to the fact that you could be sued by somebody who is not happy with the way you're doing your experiments, or the government could stop your funding. So you were saying, you know, that underneath this ethics program should be warm-heartedness. And Richie was saying afterwards, that hasn't been mentioned yet in anything written about how to run those ethics courses. And I think it's extremely important. My daily life in the United States is, and in the university, I'm in a place that I took a job there because I thought this would be, you know, it would be doing good, basically. As a department chair, we have to worry about all those ethics forms where the university could be sued, NIMH stops the funding, everybody, you know, can't get their dissertations finished. So the mindset is just constantly plowing through conflicting, noisy forces. And I do think it's testable. I think that it seems very likely to me that even a slight change in this direction of reminding yourself what you're doing would be huge. You know, it's just, that's not what most people are fighting the traffic to get to the place where they can fight with each other and protect themselves from something, and then, you know, and then put it in the bank. I think it's just it's a completely different system.
The temple culture, right? What is it? Temple, the, I don't know. You know, we don't get to know about Judah. Ah, Malo, the, that's Swiss monk. Swiss, but I'm not sure. The temple, Beijing, also, right?
Well, I mean, you know,
잡아 메시지는 장대버리지. 이 스위치 방금 뒤에 뒤 영수 말해.
So when we speak of these qualities, for example, like deliberate setting a motivation and you know constant mindfulness and all of these, of course, in the Buddhist tradition, there is a deliberate practice of these faculties. But this does not mean that in our day-to-day life, ordinary people.
Now, so 권수 잠깐 맞으면 말했어요.
말해요.
잠깐 떼서 말하고. 어디든.
So it does not mean that in our day-to-day life, average person without any Buddhist training does not apply these or employ these faculties. His Holiness was given the example of airplane pilots. I mean, you have multiple switches, and he was saying that although he is someone who is supposed to have been constantly cultivating this mindfulness faculty, but if he were to be in the cockpit, he wouldn't remember any of those switches. So there's a tremendously sophisticated mindful processes going on. So he just wanted to point out that this is a naturally occurring faculty.
Coming back to kind of some core Buddhist practice in terms of the priming issue, Thubten Jinpa has done an awful lot of work in this large region called Lojong, or mind training. But within that genre, I'm thinking of one in particular, which is a constant theme, and it's called in Tibetan Kitu Lamker. And it's transforming both felicity and adversity into one's spiritual maturation, into the path. Now generally, so felicity, when things are going well, our natural kind of conate or innate inclination is to respond with attachment. Whether it's people or human relationship we like, or a situation, or the weather, or the stock market, or the administration in the White House, whatever it is, when it's going our way, we tend to have natural response of attachment, clinging and attachment. And then fear, because of course things don't stay the same. And so we're hoping that reality won't happen. And that is that things will stay the same, whereas they never do. So the attachment itself is already setting us up for anxiety. Now, on the contrary, when things go bad, then the natural response, the habitual response, is anger, hatred. And so then in this way, then we just perpetuate our own samsara, and we just create an ongoing flow of suffering, because either way we're setting ourselves up for suffering. Anger itself is miserable, and attachment itself is setting us up for anxiety. So in this mind training, it's as Dodokchen, the late 19th century, early 20th century master said, it's not enough to have just a general idea that I will transform all adversity and felicity into the spiritual path. Just having a vague idea isn't really worth much. It has to be very specific. So in a beautiful little text that he composed, he gives very specific priming of when this type of adversity takes place, how shall I deal with that? When this type, this type, this type. And so you come kind of armed with an array of primes which you memorize, but you're implementing that with mindfulness. Now mindfulness is not just being aware of what's ever taking place, it is being aware of the nature of the circumstance, but also bringing a mindfulness in the sense of recollection of your priming. So when a specific type of adversity arises, somebody abuses you, somebody behaves very, very badly on the freeway, or whatever it may be, instead of going for the habitual response, you are primed because of what you've memorized, you've reflected on already, and now you can implement it and change your whole experience of the adversity. And he says, if you get really good at this, you will not even cringe or have an avoidance to the adversity, but actually so cultivate it that you embrace it. You say, oh, this adversity, so helpful, very helpful. I wonder when the next one will come. And so he deals quite elaborately with adversity. But then he comes to felicity, and often when we get to felicity, then we relax. Now everything is going fine. I don't need Dharma so much because everything is going, I'm happy because everything is going my way externally. And he makes one statement, and I've heard it said of the Jewish people as well. In fact, I've heard this, that Odi Padamasange Mendo, that people can handle a lot of adversity, but they can't handle much felicity. Because when felicity happens, then people just become complacent. And so then he gives another array of practices that when things are going very well, instead of just being attached to them or being lazy, how do you transform those also into your spiritual maturation? So in both ways, you're primed, and so you're bringing a mindfulness, a fullness of things you've remembered to implement into your daily life. And so that would be taking the general motivation that Matthew was talking about, of the bodhicitta, of the general aspiration, and now it makes it very specific to transform your entire life into spiritual practice and move away from the notion that you're only practicing Dharma when you're sitting cross-legged on a meditation cushion.
There's a beautiful line that sort of really captures what Alan was saying, and this was composed by the 12th century, late 12th century Indian master Panchen Shakyeshiri, who came to Tibet. And he said that if everything's going well, I shall dedicate the prosperity and the excellences for the benefit of all beings. And may all beings be happy as a result of this. And if things are not going well, if I encounter adversities, may I be able to shoulder upon myself the adversities of all beings. And may through this the ocean of sufferings dry. Because these two, the happiness or felicity on the one hand and adversity and suffering on the others, are the two primary conditions that really kind of bring us up and down, that really kind of fluctuate our responses. So what the practitioner is trying to do here is to cultivate a certain way of being so that these fluctuating external circumstances do not really disrupt in a very negative way his or her being as well.
That we don't go through emotional vacillations that correspond exactly to the external vacillations. External is bound to vacillate, it always does, but if in the midst of that we can maintain this emotional, mental equilibrium, that's really the point of spiritual practice.
One of the things that was very clear, is clear now and was clear in our discussions about this at lunch, is that a major difference between the way this idea of priming has been thought of in the West to increase the likelihood that you remember certain things, that our mental content is filled with certain specific ideas, is the issue of motivation. In the Buddhist context, motivation is very clear and very direct, whereas in the experimental studies that you heard about, there really is no motivation. But one of the things that we all began to think about at lunch, Your Holiness, is that one of the reasons we all do science is because it is our belief that through the collection of scientific data and the establishment of the benefit of some of these practices and ideas that you've been speaking about, that we can use science in the West to actually increase people's motivation to undertake these kinds of mind training and other beneficial interventions that can promote compassion and other positive human qualities. So I think with that, we will now turn to Dr. Murakami, who will give his presentation.